The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Table Talk. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And today we're joined by the chef Tom Kerridge. Tom opened the pub, The Hand and Flowers, in 2005 and within a year gained his first Michelin star. In 2012, he won a second Michelin star, the first time a pub had ever done so. In 2018, he opened his first London restaurant at the Carinthia Hotel. As a chef, he has appeared on The Great British Menu, MasterChef and Saturday Kitchen, and more recently fronted his own series, How to Lose Weight for Good. His new book, The Hand and Flowers Cookbook, is out now, published by Bloomsbury. Tom, welcome to Table Talk.
Thanks very much for having us.
It's lovely to have you here, Tom. We're going to start where we always do, at the beginning. What are your earliest memories of food?
I didn't grow up as a family that we all sat around and cooked, or food was a big part of our lives. I mean, obviously food is a big part of everyone's lives because you eat it every day. But I suppose my first real kind of childhood memory of something I'm enjoying food is corned beef sandwiches with a crusty roll with English mustard on it on a Saturday evening watching a Pink Panther. That's probably the first kind of, I knew it was a Saturday night when we were having corned beef sandwiches. So that was kind of like, that's kind of my first remembering food as something that was quite special, flavours that I really enjoyed rather than just eating stuff. So I suppose I must have been about 5 or 6, I imagine.
And was food in your house, would you sort of eat the same thing on a Monday and a Tuesday and a Wednesday like you did on the Saturday, or was Saturday like a ritual?
That was kind of one of those Saturday things. And then after that, so in between those ages, and so my mum and dad split up when I was 11. It was quite a bumpy marriage is probably the best way of describing it. So as a kid, there was, from my point of view, there wasn't very much in the way of defined structure in terms of that it was routine or how the days worked. And then the biggest thing, I suppose, is growing up then as a single parent family, myself and my younger brother, who's younger by about 2.5, 3 years, was a case of my mum ended up having two jobs because she needed to, she worked as a secretary during the day and then worked in a pub in the evenings washing up. So it was kind of like we were known at that point as latchkey kids. So we would come home from school and I would cook for my brother. But I wasn't like enjoying cooking food and experimenting, making lovely curries it was more a case of putting bird's eye potato waffles under the grill and seeing what happens, and Findus crispy pancakes and that just standard tea from the 80s. But it was probably my first insight into food being that there's an end result where you work for something, you create something, you do something, and there's an end result that you then get to eat. It's part of you. It then becomes part of a process. So that was my first real experience of understanding what food was, but I still wasn't, I'm going to be a chef, this is what I'm going to do.
And what about school food? Do you have happy memories of school food or terrible memories of school food?
We were entitled to free school meals because my mum had very little in the way of cash and obviously being single parent family, but I never used them. We never had them. My mum would quite often send us to school with a packed lunch. So it would always be like sandwiches, probably packet of crisps, that sort of stuff. Or sometimes she'd give us a bit of cash to buy something from the school as a canteen. Like they would used to do like a cheese and salad sandwich, which is always really nice. But I have to be honest, most of the time, if we had the money, I'd go to the shop round the corner and spend it on single cigarettes.
Presumably, in a low-income family, you weren't dining out at Michelin-starred restaurants all the time as a child. Where did the interest in restaurants come from?
No, there was no... I grew up on an estate in Gloucester, and there was nothing Michelin. The only thing Michelin was tyres on people's cars, and most of them were getting robbed or slashed with knives. So I've got to be honest, the closest I came to it wasn't... in terms of going out for what was deemed as a posh family meal, like a birthday or a special treat, would be going to somewhere like the Burnie Inns. Now, neither of you two are old enough to remember that. However, they were the kind of like the first chain of pubs, I suppose, that would do, and they would do things like half a beer, half a roast chicken served with like peas and chips and stuff like that. But it was a kind of an occasion of going out that wasn't just like fish and chips from a takeaway. So those were my first experiences of really going out. But it was the industry when I fell into, you know, I went into it as an 18-year-old. I needed a job washing up. So it was just the money kind of thing but I didn't fall in love with food straight away. I fell in love with the industry, the people, the space, the energy that it created, the left field way of life, the way that life is very different to everybody else. Everyone else in my class or my school was leaving school and getting a job as, I don't know, on building sites or in offices or wherever they could get, you know. Walls Ice Cream was based in Gloucester, so there was people working there, and it was just kind of like jobs where people would exist for 8 hours and then live for a weekend. Whereas the moment that you walk into the hospitality industry, it becomes an all-encompassing way of life. All of a sudden, you become that person. It's not a job. You are a chef, or you are a member of waiting staff, or you are a hotelier, or you become. It isn't just a job. And the best people in any walk of life, they are, it's much more than, you know, you guys, you're journalists. That is your life. You're not a journalist for 8 hours of the day, and then the rest of the time you're a mum or a wife or a whatever else you get on with. You are. It is your whole life. You're always working. And that's the same as for the hospitality industry. It becomes hugely encapsulating, and it becomes a massive part of who you are. And I liked that it, as an 18-year-old, it was quite defining. It was quite I suddenly found, I suppose, solace in it, and a space where you could, I mean, the energy that you get from kitchens and working in that environment is amazing. You know, you're working weekends, you're working, everyone else is out and about and having fun. You're the person that's providing for it. And people will talk about the hospitality industry having very little in the way of social life. In fact, it's the complete opposite. The social life is the best social life. It's just different. It's just different hours. You know the best bars and the best people and the best places to go. And on your days off, you could go and eat some lovely food. And, you know the industry. You know, you are providing that industry. You're part of that industry. So your social life is amazing. You just have to look at life very, very differently. It just becomes a very different way of life. But it's hugely exciting. It's massively, it's diverse. It's eclectic. It's rich, culturally rich. So many different people. It's the most embracing industry in the world. It doesn't matter your background, how much money you've got, which country you come from, what color your skin is, what sexuality you are. It really doesn't matter that you are in it, because you're all part of creating an environment and a vibe and a space that's great for guests. And you're all in it because if you're in it with the right passion, it's not about the money that you're earning. You're in it because you're passionate about what you do. So it makes it such a wonderful place to meet people of such diverse cultures and backgrounds, whether you know, and also education is huge. You know, you'll go through people that, I've got a head chef that's got a degree in forensic science, but I also left school with very little in the way of qualifications. So, you know, it's such a huge diverse mix of people, but it has so much structure and it has discipline and it has quite a, I suppose, regimented way of life. You know, you go through, you start at the bottom and you can build yourself up. It's very easy to see the ladders that you can work, but then it also diversifies. You know, you can start as a waiter, but you can end up being an incredible hotel manager, or you could start as a kitchen porter and end up being, you know, an executive chef. It really doesn't matter. You can see, and you can go from being a chef and to being, you know, a food and beverage director. You know, it's so diverse, but you can see, you can define a career path moving out of it, and that makes it such an amazing and an exciting space to be when you enter it as an 18-year-old. If you can visualize further down that line where you're going to head, and it takes you around the world. So yeah, it grabbed me very, very quickly as an 18-year-old.
I was going to ask about the structure, because it is a notoriously hard job, both physically and mentally, and quite unlike anything most people who go into it have done before. Did you take to that immediately, or was it a shock to the system?
I think if you walk into it completely open-minded, then it suddenly becomes quite exciting. I think most people after doing a productive, hard day's work, no matter what your work is, if you feel that you've achieved something, it's amazing, isn't it? You come away from it going, I've had a great day. It doesn't matter what job you're in. So if you're not shy of hard work, then it's the best industry to be in. And it's also exciting. It's creative. It touches so many different bases. If you think, you know, there is an adrenaline factor to it, you know, particularly being in a restaurant point of view where you have timescales and you have twice a day where you have to be ready for lunch and dinner and you're under pressure for both times, both services. And so there's also an adrenaline factor as well. And yes, it is exhausting, particularly if, you know, you're not quite used to it. And you're the fact that the way your shift patterns might work, that you might finish working at midnight, but you're on the breakfast shift the next morning and you're going home for 4 hours or something. It's kind of like that is, yeah, it does take out. But it also is, when you push yourself to those sort of extremes and those limits, the return you get out of it in terms of enjoyment, you have to be the sort of person that enjoys that. You have to be the sort of person that, I don't know, that likes really pushing themselves at the gym, or likes, you know, a physical activity, or likes mental stress that comes through the other side and challenges. If you're somebody who likes challenging yourself or being facing challenges head on, then the hospitality industry is incredible for that, because you can, there's always lots of challenges.
And Tom, what is it exactly about pubs that you love? I mean, your restaurant one that was the first pub ever to be awarded a Michelin star. What's the secret to a great pub?
Oh my God, the secret to a great pub, I mean, you can't put your finger on it. I think it's the same as any restaurant or any environment or any space that you try to create. There isn't one singular thing that makes them amazing, but there's much more to a pub than just food. And that's where the pub scene massively attracted me as a chef. So I'd worked in those Michelin star restaurants and hotels. My background was always in that space. But then moving from it, when I wanted to open my own space, I was very comfortable in a pub on my days off. They were always the place that I'd like to be. They were always, you know, but the energy and the atmosphere that pubs create, people, they're an environment where everybody is welcome. So it's not just for a select few. Whereas top end restaurants, sometimes people are intimidated by them, particularly from the background where I grew up. You know, many of the guys that I went to school with would be, the thought of walking into a 2-Michelin star restaurant, it's just like, I mean, that adage of going, I wouldn't know which knife and fork to use. I mean, you would know which knife and fork to use, but at the same point, just that fact that you're feeling slightly intimidated, you don't know the wine list, or you don't know all of that sort of stuff, that actually the reality of those restaurants isn't like that. You know, those restaurants work really well because they make everybody feel welcome. But a pub, instantly, everybody knows what to do. You walk through the door, there's beer pumps there on the bar, there's somebody who smiles and says hello, and straight away you feel welcome. You know, from an early age we've all been going to pubs, whether it's as a kid sitting in a beer garden in the, you know, at the back having a panda pop and a packet of pork scratchings, or whether it's as a grown-up or a young adult, your first ventures into a pub and ordering a pint of lager, maybe with some fake ID, or, you know, going into that point where pubs are places of, then places of noise, of comfort. They're places where people recognise each other. They're places where people meet up and there's a warmth of hospitality. And then the idea of it being adding food to that has helped create, I think that pub scene has grown massively over the last 20 plus years, where you were able to cook homely, satisfying and recognise food that wasn't too far removed. You haven't got to push boundaries. And so what we did at the Hand of Flowers is just, you know, when I first opened it, it was looking at, you know, top end restaurants where I was cooking before. We were using fillets of beef, which are amazing, but there's 2 small fillets on a whole carcass of an animal. So what happens to the rest of it? There's still the brisket, there's still the shins, there's still the oxtail. That animal that's been well looked after, you know, there is obviously difference in the animals, you know, the story of it, the history of where that animal comes from in terms of the way it's been looked after. You know, it's a whole period of 18 months, 2 years, 3 years of growth, well looked after by farmers, what it's been fed, and then the process of the abattoir, the process of the butchery, the process of the meat, all of that. I mean, you can get incredible meat and fantastic carcasses, or you can get really cheap stuff and horrible stuff. If you're using incredibly expensive, those carcasses, the brisket is still there, the shin is still there. So if you're using that in the top end restaurant of the fillet, from my point of view, I thought, well, there's the rest of that amazing animal to be used. So there's no reason why we can't use that and utilize it in a pub, which makes it slightly more economic to be able to still have great food that's accessible. So a braise and a stew and those sort of things work really, really well to creating flavors that are comfortable so that it sits really nicely in a pub. And that was our first point of view of trying to get things across that make people feel comfortable, but still using top end and high end produce. And having flavours that people recognise were always really important. So, you know, fish and chips were on from the beginning, steak and chips were on from the beginning. It has changed and it has grown and developed, particularly in the steak point of view. We've gone from, you know, we started off with rump steaks and we then moved through to fillet and then we've now on to sirloins. But, you know, and producers and suppliers, as you grow, you find more exceptional produce, more exceptional opportunities to showcase what you do. But at the same point, it's still steak and chips with béarnaise sauce, or it's still fish and chips at a lunchtime, and you know, at two Michelin star level. But it still means that when you come through that door, there's something there that you recognize, irrespective of your background and whether you've eaten in Michelin star restaurants before.
And your latest book is The Hand and Flowers Cookbook. How do you go about translating pub cooking, yes, but two Michelin star pub cooking for the cookbook reader and the home cook?
So it's quite a difficult one, this, because this needed to be, this is, The Hand of Flowers is 15 years old, and I wanted it to be a complete kind of understanding of the journey of the last 15 years. So there's dishes that have been on there at the beginning to dishes that are on there now. And at the beginning, there was myself and two other guys in the kitchen just running around making a creme brulee or a smoked haddock omelette. And then now there's a full brigade. You know, every service, there's at least 12 chefs on for each service. So that what you can do, the levels and the complexity of a dish can be much more. But the complexity that we work out at The Hand of Flowers is always in the prep work, in the mise en place. So it still creates a simplistic dish at the end, but the work goes in behind the scenes. So those 12 chefs are working incredibly hard to create a singular dish that looks relatively simple. However, the layers and layers and layers of flavor and process. So to try and get that across in terms of what we do, this book ticks two boxes. It ticks the box of, it is a two Michelin star cookery book that people in the industry will love and want. It also means that if you come to The Hand of Flowers or you've eaten there, you've bought into something that is the top end of British cookery, it's a reflection of that. It can be one of those coffee table books and something that has beautiful vision in it and is something that reflects 15 years of history. But also what we've done is each individual recipe or each individual dish, we've taken each component and broken it down as a singular thing. So the tuile recipe that goes with an ice cream or with a smoked salmon dish or whatever else. So you can take individual elements of something to create at home that might be nice with something that you do. But if you wanted to create the whole dish, the whole process is there. So it kind of ticks both of those boxes.
There's at the front of the book, there's a fun photo of you and Liam Gallagher. Is he a regular at the pub?
No, he's not a regular. He's so he booked it. So he's I know Liam relatively well. I've met him a few times, and he wanted to come for lunch. And so I'm friends with some members of another band, and Liam knows them very well. And he said, "Listen, get us into The Hand of Flowers. I want to come for Sunday lunch." And to me, it was a real nightmare because we couldn't find the space in our diary or in his for 9 months. So it took 9 months before Liam could come in for Sunday lunch. And he came in for Sunday lunch. His table was booked for 1 o'clock and he got there about 11:30. He was so excited. And he went, he never not once stopped being Liam Gallagher. He had his parka on for the whole of lunch. I mean, and he was such high energy and he was brilliant. He was, I mean, he's a cartoon character of Liam Gallagher. If you imagine what he is, just like that person, and he's amazing. And he was really good fun. He was great to have in a restaurant. He was brilliant in the kitchen. And I went through the process. So I'm a huge Oasis fan. I'm a huge music lover. And for me, when Liam came in, he said, "Can Tom sign me a load of cookbooks?" And I said, "Only if he'll sign my Definitely Maybe album." And it was kind of like one of those fair swaps. So he came in, which was brilliant. But for that point of view, in terms of his photo at the front, I was looking for what we would do as the foreword, because every cookbook has great forewords put by people. And I didn't quite know how to angle it and where I wanted to go, because I thought you could get a great chef to write something amazing about what they think of pubs and food. You could ask Raymond Blanc, or we could ask Heston, who was one of our first customers. Heston, the Fat Duck, is just around the corner, and he used to live in Marlow. He used to live opposite the Hand and Flowers. So, you know, I thought we could go with all of this. I could get that. But then it suddenly becomes quite over chefy, and I didn't want it to be, you know, it has to connect to people the same as the pub does. You know, it is a top-end cookbook and it is top-end recipes, but at the same point, it still needs to have that connection to everybody. So then I thought, well, what about people that are a bit more diverse or interesting? Could it be a sports people that have eaten with this? Could it be a movie star? Could it be an... And then I thought it'd be even better than that. So I just... We dropped Liam an email and said, "Look, do you, when you came, you did the, he did that tweet afterwards with that picture. He wanted a selfie. He did the tweet, and I thought, do you know what, like, it takes away all the stress of thinking of who can do the forward and ask him to do it. Let's just have Liam Gallagher's tweets." And because if you do follow him on Twitter, I mean, he is one of the greatest philosophers of our time.
He's good value.
He's amazing. Yeah, absolutely. Liam Gallagher should be Prime Minister. That's my view. He should be running the country. So from my point of view, So I just went with, great, let's ask Liam. And he was like, yeah, absolutely, be brilliant. Yeah, so yeah, please feel free to use it. So it kind of it eradicated the issue of who to ask to do the foreword. And also, I mean, it connects to quite a few people, particularly chefs or people of my age that remember, you know, the 90s of clearly being the greatest time for music.
And good pub food taps into a nostalgia. You talk about making sure that there were classic dishes on the menu, the steak and chips and the fish and chips and the fish pie, that sort of thing. What is comfort food for you? What is your ultimate comfort food?
See, they vary. It can be so many different things. And by comfort food, I mean, see, this is where what makes a great pub, going back to that earlier question, it's so many different things. It's when you walk into a room, a great pub is more than just the beers it serves, which have to be looked after and well looked at, you know, and a good range. You have to have a warm, smiley face. You have to have people that say hello. You have to have an environment and space that you feel comfortable. And that's the same as comfort food. And you can, the added thing of comfort food, and most people imagine it when you talk about it being somewhere at home, is that added, there's that nostalgic smell. And smells are amazing. I remember coming home Sunday mornings from rugby training with some mates and going through the door and my mum having done a roast dinner, and the smell of your mum's roast dinner, everyone will say that their mum does the best roast dinner, and it's because you feel comforted. You've come home. It's a safe environment. It's lovely. So for me, comfort food is something that's always makes you feel that you're in a safe space, and that can be anywhere. So it could be fish and chips in a pub. It could be fish and chips sat on a beach in Brighton in the winter time when it's raining and cold, but you're just wrapped up snug and warm, and then you go and have a hot chocolate. That's comfort food. Those sort of things are things that make you feel lovely and comfortable. But from my point of view, I suppose when I cook at home, one of the big things, I love slow roast meat. So the idea of a shoulder of lamb that you stick in the oven at 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, and you're not going to eat until 2 or 3 in the afternoon, that slow roasting, that slow cooking, go out, walk the dogs, do whatever else, come home, and that when you open that front door, and that not only do you feel warm and comforting because you're home, there's also the smell, and that's really important. Things that are just comfort food is something that creates a rounded environment that helps you kind of like wrap up in this big blanket of safety, I think.
What's it been like running a pub in the last few months with lockdown and then all these new restrictions that have come in?
I mean, a fucking nightmare, I've got to be honest. Like, yeah, I mean, in all honesty, it's been incredibly difficult. The same as, you know, the whole of the hospitality industry. I mean, everybody's industry. There's so many places that have been pushed to the limit of survival and still not coming through the other side. So it's been incredibly difficult. You know, we've got the two pubs and a butcher. Well, we've got three pubs in Marlow. We've got one of which is a butcher's and a pub. So at the minute, that's just running solely as a retail space, which is fine. It's great. It still has that warmth and connection. But then the Hand of Flowers and the Coach was very difficult. The first and foremost, the biggest thing, one of the biggest things that we're proud of over the last 15 years is staff retention and people that have grown with us on an organic level that are head chefs in Manchester and in here in London, and head chefs that have been with us for years and years and years, and front of house staff as well. So general manager and restaurant managers that have been with us for well over a decade, you know. And so your first fear as a business owner is actually staff and staff retention, and how do they pay their mortgages? How do they pay for their families to eat? How do they... So the first fear was that initial point where we were being told not to go to pubs and restaurants, but we weren't officially closed. There was about 4 days in the middle there that was, I mean, terrifying, because no one was giving any clarity, any advice, until we then got the conversation of what was going to happen with the furlough scheme, which for that point, our point of view then goes, okay, then that puts safety on the staff short term. There we are, short term, people can get paid. And we decided as a business that we would pay everybody their 80% irrespective of how much they earned. So if you were in the business earning up to the threshold, that was fine. If you were in the business and you were earning a lot more, because there's some bigger earners in our company, that you go, we'll pay them their 80% as well, because everyone lives to their earnings, don't they? You know, you buy a house, or you rent a flat, or you have kids, and you have, you know, your outgoings are still, you know, eight to lose that amount. So for our point of view, we decided as a company to make sure that we would do everything within our power to top everybody up to be able to survive at that point. But then we also thought, I set up a charity. We thought, well, one of our companies is an event company, and obviously that shut down completely. There was nothing there, but it has a great big production kitchen. So furloughed staff, we asked if they'd like to volunteer. We responded to a tweet from Wexham Park, which is a hospital in Slough, which was saying that they were very much in need of food and supplies because they're for their staff, because their staff were finishing late at night. Supermarkets were closed, or if they could get to the supermarket, there was nothing there because everyone was stockpiling everything. So, and they were eating out of vending machines. So we thought, well, listen, let's do some ready meals and send them in some ready meals. So I spoke to suppliers about, listen, do you want to send us in some stuff? We'll cook it and we'll send it to the hospital. And actually, within the first weekend of setting it up, I set up a GoFundMe page and put a little shout out. And within the first weekend, we raised £75,000. And all the producers and suppliers were just giving us so much food to be able to try and create. What it did is it gave lots of people a route into helping, because we saw all the nightmares on the news, but we couldn't, as human beings, we were just sat watching the NHS and we couldn't do anything about it. You can't get out there and help because you're being told to stay in. So it gave suppliers the opportunity to feel that they were doing something. It gave all of our staff an opportunity to feel that they were being proactive. So in the end, we fed over 80,000 meals and raised over £180,000. And then we've kept it running. We've set it up now as a fully fledged charity that we're continuing to feed vulnerable and needy within the area. Not the NHS anymore. We've handed that back to the government. So that's their job. But yeah, vulnerable and needy. And that was really good as well, because there were so many people that were lonely, that needed connection, you know, that needed, you know, the idea of someone going around the house, ringing their doorbell, leaving a meal on their step and standing back and having a conversation with them from 2 or 3 meters away, just connecting to people in society that felt just very vulnerable and alone. Once a day, somebody saying hello was such a wonderful thing to be a part of, for not just me, but for everybody that was hugely involved in it. And I live in an amazing area. Marlow's such a fantastic and community-led space, where there were so many people in the way of volunteers that wanted to deliver food, that wanted to get out there and help everybody. So it was it ended up being such a wonderful thing to do, which helped take my mind off the nightmares of what was going on, and then helped refocus of going, actually, all my staff, they're amazing. They're wonderful people, and they can't wait to get back to being active and working. So it helped you help us refocus in a positive attitude to get to that July the 4th date of reopening. So I feel that it put us in a stronger position by doing good for the area, but it was still and still is now very, very nerve-wracking and very worrying about how the hospitality industry on the whole in general survives.
Tom, thank you so much for joining Table Talk. Tom's latest book, The Hand and Flowers Cookbook, is published by Bloomsbury and available from the 12th of November.
Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink Podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories, and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.